theology of the cross. We've been looking at the cross during the day, the theology of the cross. This morning looked at Luther's theology of the cross. Now we'll back up 300 years before Martin Luther to St. Francis of Assisi and his theology of the cross. I want to begin by a story that John Schramm has told us in sermons, and if he is planning on telling it real soon again, I apologize. I didn't ask permission. It's okay. This is about swimming at the beach in California, and I spent my high school years in Southern California, so this brings back memories. But when you go to the beach, there's really three kinds of people on the beach, if you want to categorize. There's one, the sunners. These are the people that are just there only to lie on the beach, get a suntan, and have no intention whatsoever of getting into the water. The second are the waders, the ones that just kind of run out a little into the water, and it's too cold, so they scream and giggle for a while and then run back to the beach. And they are the ones that are in just far enough for it to be miserable. Okay, then there's the third kind, and they're way out in the deep, and they're frolicking, and they're having all kinds of fun in the deep water. And the next hour, we are going to look at a Christian who has maybe gone deeper into what it means to follow Christ than maybe any other human being that has ever lived. And we remember him as St. Francis of Assisi. Problem with talking to audiences or a group like this that is mostly Lutheran, it's hard to start talking about St. Francis because we do not know his story. I think if you'd grown up in a Roman Catholic school, you probably from childhood would have learned kind of the basic things of the life of St. Francis. I'm just wondering if anybody here has kind of learned the basic happenings in the life of St. Francis. You grew up in Catholic schools, right? Some of you did. And for those of you who do, I'll apologize now for just a few minutes. I'll have a quick review because I need to say that, and then I'm going to pull out some events from and thoughts from the life of St. Francis to define what his theology of the cross was. Francis was born in 1182, and thus we celebrate the 800th anniversary this year of the birth of St. Francis. And I just heard today, beginning, I believe, October 8th, there will even be a St. Francis postage stamp. So run to your post office on the 8th of October and get a Francis stamp for the 800th anniversary. Francis was born into the family of a wealthy merchant, cloth merchant, whose name was Pietro. And Pietro was what was called then the new rich, formerly part of the peasant class, but a merchant who, because of the Crusades and the opening of trade routes in the Crusades, became rich. So Francis was his son and grew up to really do what money can do. Now you have to understand that Francis was not the personality that we imagine him by the statues we see in the gardens, serene with birds. Isn't that somewhat of our picture? This just serene man that stands so still and is so quiet that birds can just light on him for hundreds of years. He's so serene. The opposite is the personality of Francis. You could describe his personality with words like extravagance. He was prodigal. And he had an immense facility to charm people. He was the campus clown, if you would say. He was a comedian. He was the life of the party. And everything he did, he went all the way. And that was true in his early years when he became a knight, a soldier, and had the greatest armor of anybody in town. He had fancier clothes than anybody, and of course he could. His father was the Calvin Klein of Northern Italy. He was a knight, and he went about it big. And he threw big parties, but always had a sensitivity to people. Well, he went off to the army once and became a POW, then went off a second time in the grandest knight's outfit that money could buy. This was in 1204, and he had doubts and dreams and visions on the way, and he said, I don't feel like doing this, I think I'll go home. So we'd think, well, he must have gone home then and started being a saint. No, he went home to be the king of the feast, and through the biggest parties that Assisi had ever seen, he not only provided all the food, but also he personally provided the entertainment with his comedy schemes. Then there's basically four changes that really happened in the life of St. Francis. One was he had begun to have doubts about this style of life, and he also hated lepers, or he just couldn't stand lepers. In fact, society couldn't stand lepers and would have nothing to do with them. And once Francis was just walking along, saw a leper that was in a deplorable condition of skin, and Francis, in tears, ran up to him, embraced him, and kissed him on the lips and asked his forgiveness. Imagine if this was your ordinary day in the life of a leper and this happened. And this really changed Francis's life, and some would say this was his conversion. After kissing the leper, he began having fun, but his new fun was giving to the poor. Everything he could find, including some of his father's stuff, he started giving away and enjoying it immensely. In 1206, he was wandering out in the fields outside of Assisi, came to an abandoned church, and there saw Jesus on the cross in a crucifix, and heard the voice of that crucifix say, "Restore my house." Francis, being a literalist all his life, thought that, of course, meant to build this abandoned church, which was now run down. But I could pause here that the rest of Francis' life is answering the question. The call from this crucifix was, "Restore my house." How do we restore the house of God? Well, at first he thought it meant stones. So he began selling his father's cloth to buy stones to rebuild this church. And his father responded by arresting him and taking him to trial before the bishop. And it is at that point is another real change in the life of Francis, where he took off all of his clothes, gave his clothes, and they were elegant clothes, back to his father. And then he said, "The rest of my life, I will embrace the poor," and put upon himself the tunic of a beggar, put a rope around him, and then went off to be with the beggars and to be one with the beggars. Okay, up to this point, he did not have a clear, definite understanding of his mission in life, except he was having a lot of fun. And you don't ever think of Francis saying, "Oh my goodness, now I have to give something away." He couldn't give enough away. It was so much fun. All the fun he had had throwing parties at one time, now he has fun giving away to the poor. And the economic situation at that time was where there were many poor because of a social change, that there was no longer the strict feudal system where the poor were really taken care of by the nobility, but the merchants that now controlled these cities meant the poor lived in miserable poverty with no rights, and lucky if they could find meager work. And so for many of them, life was to beg. 1208, Francis went to Mass and heard the gospel read from Matthew 10, where Jesus calls the disciples and he sends them out and tells them to go out with nothing, no possessions, but go out to preach the gospel. And so Francis said, "Ah, that is my mission in life, to go out like the first disciples with nothing to preach the gospel." So he just went out and started preaching the gospel that he read in Matthew, the same message as Jesus. He walked out to all of these people who thought they were church people, and everybody is a church person, remember? And he said, "Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand." And he started to gather followers, others, and they formed a brotherhood, and they made a promise to one another as a brotherhood. They promised obedience, they promised chastity, and they promised total poverty. Now, total poverty meant that you own absolutely nothing, except maybe the one piece of clothing on your back and the rope that holds it together. Absolutely nothing. In 1209, the little band went to Rome to appear before Pope Innocent III. And remember, the papacy is now at the height of its temporal power in history. And they ask if their little order of monks would be approved by the Pope. And if the story is too long to tell here how, and I'm going to refer back to it in a few minutes, but it was approved. And then he and the other brothers and a growing brotherhood, and also at this time, Francis's dear friend Claire also accepted the life of poverty and began also a sisterhood called the Poor Clares. By the way, both the Poor Clares and the Franciscans still exist today. Then they went out for a ministry, and it was a ministry of begging and preaching and reconciling and sharing and singing, and they really did sing. Francis saw himself and his little group as a group of medieval troubadours. They just went singing and preaching from town to town and laughing. And the historians tell us that they just laughed everywhere they went in the joy of what they were doing. Then he sent out the brothers to preach in different countries in Europe. And Francis' mission, and he wanted to be a missionary. Part of Francis' life, he was always frustrated. He tried to go to Spain to be a missionary to the Muslims, and he got sick. Then he finally made it to Egypt. This is during the Crusades. He tried to stop the Crusades. The Christian general wouldn't listen to him because he said, we must fight for the glory of the church. And so Francis went to the Muslim general, the Sultan of Egypt, and walked right into his camp and his armed camp and asked him to stop the war. He didn't stop the war, but he gained the Sultan of Egypt had a tremendous respect for this little monk. But while he was away in Egypt, the brotherhood fell into confusion, and it was a confusion over two different, by this time there are thousands in the brotherhood of the Franciscans. And it was a confusion or a tension between the ones who followed Francis and said, we will live as Jesus called us to live with nothing, with no possessions, totally divested of all possessions. And then there was other monks who said, now come now, we must be a little more realistic than that. At least we have to have monasteries that have some furniture and some books, and we have to own a few things, not as individuals, but at least our order. We must own some things, and there's tremendous tension. And Francis came back and realized he had lost the brotherhood. And the more practical, we would say, leadership had taken over. And Francis then went off by himself to live in a cave in depression and in sickness. And then it was at that point that is called the temptation of Saint Francis. And it was on this very day, September 14, the day of the Holy Cross, what is called Francis's dark day of temptation. Should I go back and try to retake the order of brothers and use politics and gather as many monks as possible to reestablish my leadership? And it was on that Holy Cross day when Francis was tempted. And instead of doing that, he instead went more deeply into his life of suffering with Christ and Christ's passion, and I'll refer back to that in a minute. After that, he went on his last preaching journeys until he was too sick. He became very sick, and many think he had some form of cancer. During his sickness, he wrote the magnificent canticle to Brother Sun that we sing as all creatures of our God and King. Towards the last days of his life, he reconciled, as he had reconciled so many people in his life, the mayor and bishop of Assisi, who were ready to go to war. And then he wrote the peace verse of all creatures of our God and King. And then in his last days before death, he wrote the verse to come. find death. And it was on October 4, early in the morning of October 4, 1226, that Francis died. And we're told that he asked before his death that all of his clothes be taken off and that it be placed on the dirt floor of the hut, so he could die as he had lived, with nothing and close to Mother Earth. Or we would say he died hand in hand, at one hand Lady Poverty, and the other hand Mother Earth. It's called his two lovers. Well, that's a brief review of the life of Francis. Now I want to back up and return to what John was talking about early today about the theology of glory. The theology of glory is, among many other things, is a sense of triumphalism in the church. That, my, don't we believe more strongly if our churches are really succeeding? And if we have marvelous structures and institutions and have a sense of wealth and power, and that we're moving forward from one success to another. And this was the church at the time of St. Francis. The church was in its height of power. The Pope could literally take kings off of their thrones, remove kings, shuffle kings around. The Pope had power over every nation, at least in Europe. It was a time when the church had military power. They didn't have to just encourage the government to fight. The church had its own armies that were the best armies in Europe at that time. Bishops had their own armies. The Pope had an army. And most of the Christian armies were in the Palestine, slaughtering Muslims for the glory of Christ and the glory of the church, killing in the name of Jesus. It was also a time with all of this wonder and marvelous wealth of the church, also a time of immorality and corruption from the papacy down to the bishops, down to the parish priests. The one word to define the church was corrupt. But it was also a time of tremendous charity. People were building chapels and churches and cathedrals and hospitals, and probably the reason so much charity was going on was that so many people who called themselves Christians were shedding so much blood, killing so many people, that finally, towards the end of their life, after accumulating so much wealth just in guilt, they would build a hospital or a chapel to some way absolve their guilt. It was into this church that believed that somehow it had reached its greatest glory that Francis came and lived what 300 years later Martin Luther would call the theology of the cross. And now I want to try to define what Francis meant by living the theology of the cross, or he didn't use that word, that's a Luther word. But when we look at the life of St. Francis, it would be simply this, that to Francis, Christ was all. Christ was everything. Christ was the beginning, the ending, all. Francis loved Christ. Francis prayed to Christ, lived with Christ, heard the story of Christ over and over again, loved the Eucharist. Francis loved Christ. But, and this is very important, Francis's Christ was the Christ of the New Testament. So often we take our idea of what Christianity should be. If it's success, we make a Christ who is worldly or practices worldly success. If to be a Christian is to be handsome and beautiful, we make a handsome and beautiful Christ. If to be a Christian is to be wealthy, we make a Christ that encourages wealth. We fashion a Christ. But the Christ that Francis so passionately loved was the Christ of the New Testament witness, the gospel picture of Christ. Nowhere is the Christ of Francis more clearly stated than in Philippians 2. Have this mind among you that is in Christ Jesus. Though equal with God, he did not grasp equality with God, but emptied himself and took the form of a slave. Being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Francis grasped this Christ, the Christ of the Bible, as a Christ that embraced the poverty of humankind and came to live with the poor. It was for this reason that above all, it seems like of all the feasts of the year, Francis loved Christmas the most. We might call him a Christmas Christian. Do you know that Francis invented the creche? You know, think of that when you put your little creche scene under the Christmas tree. That when Francis was in his despair after he had lost the Brotherhood, he came out of the cave once and set up a little manger and brought animals around it, and the people of Assisi flocked out to the cave, and Francis had a priest lead the mass, and Francis preached the sermon, and Francis just wept in that sermon because of the poverty of God to be born in a barn surrounded by animals. And the story is told that once Christmas fell on Friday, and that's a fast day, and some of the more pious, we would say pious in a negative, monks came up to Francis and said, "This is Friday, it's a fast day, we certainly will fast, even if it's Christmas." And Francis ordered a feast. I don't know where the food came from, but it was luscious meat. And when he gathered all the monks for this feast of Christmas, he shouted to the walls of the room to join them for the feast. And when the walls refused, Francis took the meat and all the grease and threw it at the walls and smeared all the walls with the grease from the Christmas meat, because he said, "Even you will join our feast because Christ is born." I like that story. Because Francis loved Christmas, and this was a day to celebrate because God had become poor. Now, told the story and lost my place. Oh, okay. When Francis grasped the Christ of the cross, he understood to follow that Christ was to give up everything. When Jesus calls Francis to follow, Francis understands that it means exactly that, to give up everything. And so he gives his clothes away to his father. Everything he ever receives, he gives away to the poor. He embraces poverty, he becomes poor, and poverty to Francis is to depend every day anew on God for daily bread and sustenance, as Christ depended each day on the Father. And Francis was not applauded for this, and this is a sense of the way of the cross. He was laughed at. You know, it's probably most of us, if we were living in Assisi, we'd probably laugh. But to Francis, this was such joy. And we have to understand this, and I've explained this before, that you have to turn your mind around. That we in America tend to think of joy or human advancement as the year of the new refrigerator, the year of the new car, the year of the microwave, the year of the home computer. And then we say, "Oh, happiness, we are advancing." And you have to turn this completely around, and to Francis, that would be going downhill. For joy was to give up everything and to cling only to Christ. You have to turn your American consumer mind totally around and not look at it as giving up, but as total joy. And Francis had so much fun. And his problem was, when he got rid of everything, then somebody would come and beg and ask for something. So the story is that once a beggar came when Francis had absolutely nothing left except his garb, his tunic, and he found somebody with a knife and he cut a big piece out of it and gave it away. So we at least have something to give. Or once somebody that came to their little hut and all they had left, there was no food in the hut, all they had left was their Bible that they read daily prayer, and Bibles were valuable in those days, and he wanted to give something, so he gave away the Bible. And you have to almost think, our fear is that we might lose everything. You know, don't you fear financial disaster? Francis feared getting something. Can you start making the switch? Okay. Then once you start making that tremendous mental gymnastic for us Americans, you start understanding Francis. And just think of it for him. It was fun and it was joyful freedom. The other thing Francis understood that one gives up in following Christ is any movement towards status. And the church had it in those days. You could climb from being a monk, and then you could become a monk priest, then a bishop, then an archbishop, and then a cardinal, and then maybe pope. And to Francis, it shall not be so among us. And they called themselves the Friars Minor, meaning the smallest people on earth that have no status whatsoever. And so Francis never became a priest, and he discouraged his monks from ever even going to school so they could start the advancement in what the world calls status. It was a joyful freedom. And it was this freedom that Francis realized that all of life is in Christ that gave him the bravery to walk right into the Sultan's camp. And the military Sultan of Egypt had vowed to kill every Christian that walked into his presence. And Francis, unarmed, walked up to the Sultan and said, "Why don't you become a Christian? That would stop the war." And he got a real laugh out of that one. But he impressed, and what it was a power of love. It was a power of weakness, a power of vulnerability that walked into that armed camp where they had vowed to kill any Christian. And the Sultan asked Francis finally, he liked him so much, he said, "How much money do you want? I'll give it to you." And Francis said, "What would I do with money?" And the Sultan, the story is, almost fell over because he'd never met a Christian who wasn't greedy. Now, giving up everything. One thing that Francis succeeded at, now we're going to tell his success story. Italy was so spiritually sick, the church was so spiritually sick, that many were just sick of it. And they followed Francis and became monks, or the women followed Claire and became nuns, or many followed and kept their marriage vows, kept their families together, and joined Francis's order of lay married people. Thousands followed him, and it was a strange group of people. Thousands wanting to give up everything, give up all wealth and all status. And they met every year. They called it their Pentecost meeting, and they would just find a field, and they wouldn't even have a committee to make plans. They would just all meet and figure everything would fall together, and it did. This was Francis's joy, was thousands of monks that were in the Brotherhood. And once he was asked, "Why do so many follow you when you're not handsome? In fact, you're homely. You're not learned or educated, and you're not of noble birth." And Francis' response was that of St. Paul, that somehow God chooses ignorant people like me, weak and despicable people like me, to work out the divine purpose. Now remember, years before Francis had said, "Christ, I'll give up everything for you, I'll give away all," when he came back from Egypt, he found now that he had one thing left, and that was the Brotherhood. And now that was lost. And Francis, as I said, retreated then into a cave. And it was called then the Temptation of St. Francis. Shall I return now and try to use political power to take over the order again that I have lost to the more practical monks? I just want to read this from I. Francis, where a modern contemporary monk puts words into St. Francis' mouth that try to express what he understands as the feeling of Francis. It was dawn, and the day was the 14th of September. Remember, that's today's feast day, the feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross. The night had been a terrible one, and my prayer had tasted bitter as death. The temptation to leave the mountain and return to Assisi to take back the reins of government of the order had been eating at me with continuous violence. But now I had understood that I was to live within myself the very sacrifice of Abraham. Sacrifice your child, my conscience kept repeating, while the backlash of my wicked will impelled me once more to action instead. Sacrifice your child. Sacrifice what you hold dearest, your Franciscan order, your life's dream. What saved me at that moment was a consideration of the Passion of Jesus. How true it is that to solve our problems, we must leave ourselves behind. I cast myself forth from myself and found myself to be on the way of Jesus Calvary. What was my sorrow when I looked at his? What defeat mine as compared with his? And who was I, vile little man, obdurate sinner, before the majesty of the Son of God, before the holiness of the Word incarnate? Before him my poor scale of values was set on its ear. And my story became very small, and my pain shrank away, and his presence became gigantic, and his words became more strong, and he spoke to me, Francis, accept as I accepted. I accept, Lord. Francis, sacrifice your life's work as I sacrificed mine. All betrayed me at my moment of trial. I was left alone, more alone than you. You still have friends. Yes, I felt the need then to think of my own sorrows no longer, but to offer myself to be penetrated by and to suffer with those of Christ. And this prayer surged up within me with great force, and now I feel the desire to live it again. And this is a prayer that Francis actually wrote most likely on this day, September 14. Lord Jesus, two graces I ask of thee before I die. First, to feel in my soul and in my body as far as possible the sorrow which thou, sweet Jesus, didst endure in the hour of thy most bitter passion. Second, to feel in my heart as far as possible that extraordinary love with which thou, O Son of God, wast inflamed, to the point of willingly undergoing so great a passion for us sinners. Now, the mind of Christ, when someone would reach the poverty of spirit of Francis, of letting go so completely and being so completely in Christ, totally trusting in God, The last thing to let go of, and this would be my last thing, and I know you all have discovered by now that I'm not St. Francis. I even contemplated what to wear to give this tonight. But if I had reached now the discipleship commitment of St. Francis, I would have one last thing that I would have to let go of. And that would be the pride and the judgment of those who haven't. You know what I mean? The arrogance and the pride that somehow I am more humble than those that are not as humble as I. And in the world of Francis, that was obvious. It was the church that followed a theology of glory, bishops who loved accumulation of wealth and power and military might, and the Pope. Did Francis judge them? No. In fact, he went to Pope Innocent III and always treated the priests and the bishops of the church as his spiritual overseers. And he submitted himself so completely to the Pope that the Pope laughed at him because he was dressed so funny. The Pope told him to go preach to pigs, and he did. And he put pig dung all over him, came back to the Pope and said, I have now obeyed you, now will you accept my order? And it was this kind of submission that finally disarmed even the church. So Francis never attacked the church. And why did he not attack the church? Years later, Luther put it, he said, we are all beggars. And Francis understood so deeply his own sinfulness and his own need for mercy. And he understood so deeply that the gift of poverty that he had received was totally a gift of the mercy of God. I was taught as a young Lutheran that somehow the doctrine of grace ended with Paul and nobody found it again until Luther. Was anybody here taught that? That somehow the church lost it until Luther came along? But here is Francis, who saw his weakness and his sinfulness and saw that he was totally dependent on the mercy of God for his forgiveness. And therefore his response was, how could I ever condemn a bishop or even a pope for all their concern about wealth? They need exactly what I needed, and that is the mercy of God. And where else can that mercy come to them but through me? And maybe through my mercy to them, God will also free them from their slavery to things and to status. How can I share anything but love and mercy to those who are still in bondage? I want to close with this. It is probably most striking to me from the life of St. Francis. Back in 1209, when Francis made the pilgrimage to Rome with the first brothers, and you have to picture these people in little beggars' tunics with ropes around them, bare feet, walking into this great imperial court of Pope Innocent III. And they are first laughed at by the Pope, and then because one of the cardinals is sympathetic to Francis, they are allowed to return to see the Pope again. It helps that the Pope has a dream that night also. But these words carry the day with the Pope. Emily, I always like when I say that. The cardinal said this to Pope Innocent III, if we reject this poor man's request, and that was a request to approve his order, if we reject this poor man's request on such a pretext, and the pretext was, I will get through with this quote. The pretext was Pope Innocent said, nobody can possibly follow this. No, total poverty. The cardinal said, if we reject the request on this pretext, would this not be to declare that the gospel cannot be practiced and sold to blaspheme Christ, its author. And that cardinal had a sense, as he was surrounded by the glory of the triumphant church, and Pope Innocent III, as he was surrounded by the glory of the triumphant church and had church power that we would never dream of today, looked at this little monk and had a sense that somehow this is the truth. Deep down had a sense this is the truth. And I would plead with us to have at least the honesty of this cardinal and this pope, because we tend to take the things the way they are in the church and say, this is biblical, or this is the way it ought to be, and we have 100 justifications for the way we are. And as Christians and as church people, we run after wealth, and we say we have to have all kinds of military power for our security, and we call our wealth blessings from God, and we find all kinds of justifications to say this is right. And we need a little monk in a little beggar's garb to come in and speak to us in love and mercy. And then deep down in our hearts we'll say, somehow, this is the truth. And now I want to share something personal. Now, sometimes the problem of presenting the life of St. Francis is, my goodness, that depresses me. And this is a typical Lutheran response. When we see someone who has followed the gospel so completely, we go into despair. But I would respond to that in two ways. Is a part of Francis's love and mercy was his understanding that everyone would not follow his path. And that's why he set up orders of lay people who were married and had families and also owned things. But these were people who understood the truth of St. Francis' message, and they began to live with less and less and less. And I rejoice that in a way I can do that, and by the grace of God and the mercy of God, that is the joyful life. In other words, maybe I'll never be St. Francis, but I'll be part, you know, of what he had a vision of, that kind of a lay order. And the other thing that's so encouraging to me is the life of St. Francis. And he never thought of his life as something he had earned or worked at with great difficulty to finally attain. In all of the original readings of St. Francis, there's never a sense of, I attained this level of Christian commitment. To his dying day, he thought of himself, like Paul, as a sinner in the need of God's mercy. And all the love that he shared with other people was a gift of God's mercy. And that, I think, is the way of the cross. Well, that's sharing from some of my experience with St. Francis. And I would encourage you to read a biography. I read the one by Omer Engelbert, St. Francis of Assisi. It's excellent and cheap, $2.95. And then I, Francis, is a modern monk that speaks as if he were St. Francis. And then also a beautiful coffee table book, if you have accumulated at least $21. So read it and give it away. And... well, that's my sharing, and I'd like to welcome your responses. And at the forum tonight is also a time to reflect on the life of St. Francis. Anybody? No. Now, both, most of the biographies include the Francis' original writings, and both of these do. And I think we're out of all of them, is that right? Poor business practice here at Holden. We should have had thousands of things we could have sold it. Yeah, it's one thing, Francis, of all his love and reaching out to all of nature, he had trouble taking care of his own body. He called the birds sister and brother bird and sister deer and brother snake. He called his body brother ass. So, but there is evidence he had some form of cancer that he lived in just excruciating pain at the end of his life. But even that for him in the pain was a joy because he felt he was sharing most deeply then in the suffering of Christ. It's amazing when you read biography of St. Francis is how much he knew of the Bible. You know, we kind of think the Bible was lost for 1,000 years, but he, Well, there weren't they didn't have printing presses, you know, so the Bible had to be hand copied, so it wasn't available to the common person. But somehow their order had, somebody probably had given them a Bible. But if you ever gave anything to the order, you knew it would be given away. So, but that is a correction that they, you know, they had the Bible, they learned the Bible, they loved the Bible, and they shared the Bible. And Francis, just amazing. I had this prejudice that old Catholics just didn't know their Bibles. You know, he knows the gospel. You know, so. And he didn't go to school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He knew, he probably knew most clearly the parts we don't, like the Sermon on the Mount, you know, those hard parts that we flee from, things like turn the other cheek. But true. Here's a hand here and then back there. Oh, what committed the church hierarchy to elevate Francis to? What was immediately made of St. Francis right after he dies is exactly what he wouldn't want. You know, that his body was practically still warm when they were already getting the stones together to build a magnificent church in his honor. So many people had experienced so deeply his love that there was just an immediate popular groundswell of people throughout all of Europe that immediately he was canonized, as the Roman Catholic Church does. I think less than 2 years after his death. I'm not that familiar with the present day. I'm really scared to talk about that with any authority, but I know you know, when Francis, as I said tonight, lost the order, he really lost it on the point of total poverty. You know, Franciscans have never question the point that they should own no personal possessions. You know, a Franciscan today will own no personal possessions, but often a, you know, the monastery or the brotherhood of monks will have a good, fairly good building, good furniture, and a good library. And see, that, and Francis' vision was that his followers would always just kind of wander around the world with nothing, preaching. So even today, probably the order isn't the final order that was accepted. It was called the Third Order that Francis disapproved of. Part of the reason he went into his depression was the watering down to the point of poverty. Let's see. Anybody else? Go ahead. Yeah, Francis' movement definitely was a reformation of the church. You know, all tremendous, tremendous impact all over the church. Yeah. And he had, there were many reformers at this time that were critical of the church, and the church is so powerful that those people were just stomped out. Francis had such a disarming love of the church that he just was away, he was able to, you might say, get away. And there is something disarming about meeting power, worldly power with humble love. And Francis really had that gift. You know, practically nations would crumble before his quiet love. Or you even look today at the power of St. Francis in the world. Yeah. Well, we have time for one more. Yeah. Robin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have, some of us around the village have these buttons that say Francis, everybody's saint. 1182 to 1982. And there's a deep sense, I think, that the Roman Catholic Church doesn't own Francis, that in a way his deep, deep commitment to Christ is something that we all gather before and honor and rejoice and celebrate. And for that reason, Lutheran congregations are being encouraged this fall to join with Roman Catholic parishes in celebrating and giving thanks for the life and the witness testimony of Francis. So I'd sure encourage you to run right home and encourage your congregation to celebrate Francis, and at least on in our Lutheran commemoration calendar, October 4, October 3 is a Sunday. At least on that Sunday, encourage your pastor to include thanksgiving for the life of St. Francis on that day, because by doing that you'll be part of churches of many denominations all over the world on that day that will be giving thanks for the life of this little monk. Well, shall we stretch before Vespers? And if you want to look at any of these books, I'll have them up here.